Greetings, America. Good evening, truth seekers. Happy Friday to all. It is I, Brad Friedman, your friendly citizen investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow. Yeah, once again, in for Mike. He's got the night off. He'll be back. It's a Molly day once again on Friday. So Mike and Kathy are off. They'll be back with you Monday. Until then, you got me. But don't worry, I will make it worth your while. What did I say? Oh, yeah, the guy from bradblog.com. Yeah, that's me. You can reach us throughout the night at our phone number here in beautiful Los Angeles, where we are broadcasting for the next 3 hours from the lovely studios of K-Talk AM 1150. Our phone number will be 877-520-1150. That's 877-520-1150. Write it down. You're going to want to call. I'm going to take you off, and you're going to need to call in and give me a piece of your mind. And I'm happy to have it. You can also Twitter me at TheBradBlog all night long, TheBradBlog. And we have, as usual, our live chat room up and rolling, our special Mike Malloy chat room at BradBlog.com. Stop on by. It's the top item there. Jump on in. Say hello to everyone. I think Desi's there. For Earth is there. Who else is there? Well, we'll find. You go find out who's there. They're all good folks. They'd love to hear from you. That's at the BradBlog.com chat room at the top of the very first item. I think Margot. Well, Margot's on her way. Margot's late. I'm docking her tonight. All right. She's our super duper associate producer. I may take off one of those dupers. All right, we got a big show for you tonight, as always, as ever. And although, you know what, I'm putting it all on hold for a second, because on the way over here, I stopped at my post office box, and there in my box is this book that I am now holding in my hand. This may be contraband. I may not even be able to talk about it. Some of you folks know that I have reported for years on end. I think I first started reporting on Sibel Edmonds back in 2005, I want to say. That's my best guess. She is the 9/11 FBI whistleblower. Let's call her the FBI whistleblower. She went to work at the FBI after 9/11 as a translator. The ACLU has called her the most gagged woman in the world because she saw some stuff while she was an FBI translator, and she tried to get that information out. She saw what she describes as, let's say, spying from with inside the FBI, inside the translation department there, and she tried to tell her story everywhere she could. She was fired by the FBI. The inspector general looked into her story, found that she was credible. Both Republican and Democratic U.S. senators alike found that she was very credible with her story. And yet she was gagged under the George W. Bush administration's Department of Justice. John Ashcroft went to court, used the state secrets privilege to shut her up so that she could not tell her story. She could not tell what she saw. She could not even give her name, where she went to school. That's how gagged she was under the Bush administration's gag order. And 60 Minutes did a story about her. Eventually, she began speaking because she took her case all the way to the Supreme Court. And what she was trying to tell people was that she was witness to, among other things, a network that was run at some of the highest levels of government that was actually transporting nuclear materials, selling nuclear secrets to the black market around the globe. It's an extraordinary story, and I only know it because years later, after she had gone all the way to the Supreme Court, she said, well, you know what, Brad, I'm going to tell my story, and we broke that at bradblog.com. I will tell the story to anyone in the mainstream corporate media who will hear it. I don't care. I'm going to defy the gag order if I need. They can come in and they can arrest me if they want. And, well, interestingly enough, I only got one bite back then. This was, you know, after everybody had made so much to do about the fact that she couldn't talk, like 60 Minutes, who did the special on her, ran it twice. And by the way, the Bush Justice Department retroactively classified that report on 60 Minutes. That's how sensitive they were to what she had to say. There was a huge feature story by David Rose in Vanity Fair on Sybil Edmonds. So I've been telling her story for years. Dan Ellsberg, the whistleblower from the Pentagon Papers, actually guest blogged at bradblog.com some years ago to write about Sybil and reported that, in his opinion, her story was more explosive than the Pentagon Papers. Well, now, Sybil has decided finally to tell her own story in her own book. And as a former FBI translator, according to her contract, she has to submit any such book to the FBI so that they can read it, redact any sensitive materials, any classified materials. But they have to do so within 30 days. We're now going on a year since she turned in her document, her manuscript, to the FBI to get their approval, to find out what she could and couldn't say. And they're slow-walking her case. Obviously, it's been a year, and they haven't given her the redactions that she has to include. So she has said, you know what? I'm publishing anyway. Enough is enough. I only had to wait 30 days. I've waited a year. I am now releasing my memoir. And the memoir is called Classified Woman, The Sybil Edmonds Story. It will hit the internets, hit the bookstores, if there are any left, on, I believe, May 7th. I am holding in my hands a copy of the unredacted version of Classified Woman, The Sybil Edmonds Story. I wanted to bring Sybil on tonight. She wasn't able to come on the show. She said she'll come with us a little bit later. I think we're back in for Mike in the middle of June, I think, for a week or so. We'll try to bring her back in then. But you can, if you want, and this is an unpaid, this is not an advertisement. I'm not paid to tell you this, but you can go to classifiedwoman.com right now. You can get you can pre-order a copy. It was just went on to Amazon.com late last night, I am told. And I don't know if I'm allowed to have this book unredacted, unapproved by the DOJ. You can hear, that? That's the pages of the book, the pages you're not supposed to read. But I have it right here. If the DOJ wants it, they can come and get it from me. As Charlton Heston used to say, they can pry it from my dead, cold, dead fingers. I was driving over here. I said, oh, should I say that on the air? Dez said, no, you know what? Don't tempt them. Tony agrees. He agrees because he'll be hanging out with me tonight. We'll go get some food afterwards, and he knows they're going to take him down first. You're not going to throw yourself in front of me, are you? No, you're going to run away. That's what I thought. All right. Anyway, Classified Woman. Go check out classifiedwoman.com. One hell of a story, and I suspect it's one hell of a read. Haven't read it yet, though, because I just got it on the way here. Anyway, that has thrown everything off, thrown my whole plan off just to tell you about that story. We're going to be speaking of classified, speaking of state secrets, we're going to be talking a little bit later this hour with Dan Auerbach of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Oh, man. About the newest assault on your rights, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. Because apparently the government did not have enough access to your emails, to your phone calls, to your usage of the internet. So they have to pass a new law. It just passed yesterday in the House. Another version is coming to the Senate soon. The Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. It's called CISPA. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation and a bunch of other good organizations are against this new Cyber Spying Act. I'll tell you about that next hour. I'm also going to be speaking next hour my interview with 90-year-old Joyce Block, who from Pennsylvania, where they have just passed, the Republicans out there have just passed a new photo ID restriction, polling place photo ID restriction bill. Joyce Block is 90 years old. She has voted for 70 years without fail. She was born 2 years after women got the right to vote in this country. She has never missed an election. Now she is fighting for her right to vote at 90 years old. She's fighting for her right to vote. She can't get the photo ID, the quote-unquote free photo ID that she's supposed to be allowed. Remember, you hear these bills. Oh, it's a free photo ID. Nothing to worry about. If you don't have a driver's license, don't worry. Yeah, well, she's 90 years old. Sure, she can go to the DMV. It's a half an hour away. And she doesn't drive because she has no driver's license. She would not like to see her perfect 70-year voting record broken, although the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation has denied her her photo ID. But we've got an update on that. We're going to I talked to her a little bit earlier in the week. We're going to play that interview a little bit later in the show. And quick, Tony, let's take a break. We'll come back. Oh, we got lots more show for you. Hang in there with me. Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. In for Mike. Stay with us.
This is a public service announcement with guitar. Know your rights. All three of them. Number one, you have the right not to be killed.
Well, we'll have to check the law on that. Laws may have changed. Not sure if you have that right to not be killed. Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. In from Mike on your Friday for your Friday Molly Day. Glad you could join us here tonight. Big show coming up. Don't forget to stop by the chat room where 4Earth just told me, hey, Brad, you're looking and sounding good. Well, I thank you, 4Earth. I hope I'm sounding good. How do you know what I'm looking like? Has the spying on the internet gotten even worse than I thought? Yeah, I know we're in the camera. We have cameras here. We're in Stephanie Miller's current TV studio, so they're always spying. Now so is the government. At least they would like to. Apparently it's too difficult for them to go to a judge anymore and get an order. So they're passing this new law, this cyber intelligence. What is it? Sharing Protection Act nonsense. We're going to be talking about that in a few minutes with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. A couple of items I want to try to squeeze in here. Oh, we're not going to have enough time. We're going to have to invoke the secret fourth hour again. Most independent ads for the 2012 election are from groups that don't disclose donors, says Dan Egan this week in the Washington Post. Nearly all of the independent advertising being aired for the 2012 general election campaign has come from interest groups that do not disclose their donors, suggesting that much of the political spending over the next 6 months will come from sources invisible to the public. Oh, do you think? Politically active nonprofit groups that do not reveal their funding sources have spent $28.5 million on advertising related to the November presidential matchup, $28.5 million. And this is April. And nobody knows who it actually is because it's all in secret. Wow. So that's $28.5 million or about 90% of the total through last Sunday, according to this Washington Post. 90% of the total spent on this race has come through secret sources. Welcome to America. Most of the ad spending has come in swing states from, quote-unquote, conservative groups that criticize President Obama's policies. The data shows secretive groups have spent tens of millions more targeting congressional races, again, mainly in support of Republicans, according to the Washington Post. Well, we've got some late-breaking news today that is probably good news. And I see that actually Ben from Minneapolis is calling in about this, and I don't think I'm going to – hang in there if you want, Ben. I don't know if I'm going to have time to get to the phones here for a bit. But I can – this is probably what you wanted to talk about. The FEC disclosure loophole – well, let's see. A court ruling – put it this way. A court ruling requiring non-disclosing political groups, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Koch brothers American for Prosperity – to disclose their donors is one step closer to going into effect after a district court refused to stay its ruling in the face of an appeal. On March 30th, a district court ruled in Van Hollen versus Federal Elections Commission that a loophole in the FEC rules that allowed certain independent groups, group campaign efforts to keep private the name of donors was invalid. In other words, the FEC misinterpreted the rule, misinterpreted what the Citizens United decision, misinterpreted the Supreme Court. So they wrote the rule incorrectly, basically. It was invalid, and it needs to be rewritten or reset to the original language, which does not allow these donors to remain secret. That's really good news. Now, the Republicans on the Federal Election Commission, they wanted to see this appealed because they don't want, they want to help their pals. They want to help the Koch boys keep all of their money secret, all of their donors secret. Remember that story I wrote on the secret Koch brothers tapes that I was able to acquire from their secret meeting? Yeah. They don't like this to get out. Nonetheless, so it looks like unless they can win this appeal, and so far they are not winning this appeal, if they do not win this appeal, these donors, Karl Rove's groups and all of that, these donors are going to have to be exposed unless they can come up with a different way to hide them. They're going to have to disclose who all of this money is coming from. Well, hot damn. Some good news for a change, huh? We've been fighting for that, by the way, and working with Van Hollen on this at protectourelections.org. That's a campaign of velvetrevolution.us, an organization that I helped to co-found. So please support our work there if you like. Protectourelections.org, because someone's got to. Now, who's going to protect the Internet? We'll talk about that next. Brad, in from Molloy. Somebody's going to be watching you, and the government wants to make it easier to watch you. And, you know, I'm not really, when it comes to, you know, I hear all these right-wingers, they're always worried about, oh, the government's going to do this, they're going to take away my rights, my privacy. Of course, the right-wingers don't really care about that, otherwise they'd be up in arms about the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. But, of course, they're not. You know, I'm more worried, frankly, about the corporations. This is the worst of all worlds, it seems to me, this bill, because the corporations and the government get together to spy on you. We're going to be speaking momentarily with Dan Auerbach of the Electronic Frontier Foundation about CISPA. But let me just set it up for you this way. This is from Foreign Affairs yesterday, Rebecca McKinnon. Soon after Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was ousted from power last year, protesters stormed the Egyptian National Security headquarters in which police records are housed. Some Egyptians found files the authorities had compiled about them. Others uncovered files focusing on friends and colleagues. There were wiretape transcripts, reams of printouts of intercepted emails and mobile messages, communications once thought to be private. I have to remind you, this is in Egypt. As it turns out, American-made technology had helped Mubarak and his secret state collect, compile, and parse vast amounts of data about everyday citizens. The Egyptian government was using deep packet inspection technology purchased from Naris, a Sunnyvale, California-based firm owned by Boeing. The company's most successful product is Naris Insight, which, according to Naris's website, helps, quote, network and security operators obtain real-time situational awareness of the traffic traversing their networks. In short, the same technology not only assists network administrators in pursuing attackers and intruders, it can also help governments patrol their citizens' online activities. How nice. NARIS's core clients are the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the National Security Agency, but a good portion of the company's business comes from abroad. In 2005, NARIS signed a multi-million dollar licensing deal for the use of its technology with Egypt, Palestine, Saudi Arabia, and Libya. Noting that the NARIS case this week is particularly ironic as the White House announced new sanctions against Iran and Syria on Monday aimed at technology that Tehran and Damascus are using to target their own citizens. On Monday, President Barack Obama said of the internet and mobile technologies that they, quote, should be in place to empower citizens, not suppress them. Well, that's somewhat ironic, given the bill that is now moving through the House. It was approved yesterday in the House. It's heading to the Senate to be voted on soon, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, which the White House has said it would veto, at least in its current form. Of course, they said the same thing about the NDAA that allows for U.S. citizens to be held without charges forever and so on and so forth. And then Barack Obama ended up signing it anyway. So pardon me if I don't trust him. But let's get an idea what the hell this CISPA is and what they're trying to do now. What have we done to deserve this? Well, we'll find out. I'm joined by Dan Auerbach. He's a staff technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and formerly an engineer at Google, specializing in security. Hey, Dan, great to have you. Really appreciate it. Okay, help me out here. Talk me off this ledge, if you don't mind. What problem, let's start it here. What problem is CISPA supposedly meant to cure? What's the nice way to look at this bill?
Surveillance technology being exported by U.S. companies, mm-hmm. and EFF is very concerned about that issue too. So for anyone who wants to follow up on that, you know, feel free to check out our website.
EFF.org. Yes, please do.
Yes, EFF.org. So turning to CISPA, well, it's being framed as a data sharing bill. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, oh, well, the NSA and companies can share data so that they can better defend against cyber threats.
From U.S. citizens?
It's very unclear about what sort of data, but yes, certainly it encompasses data of U.S. citizens,
so,
for instance, your emails.
Your emails. So in other words, since you were formerly an engineer at Google, you work at Google, you detect some that I, Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, I am some sort of a threat because I'm colluding with someone to make denial of service attacks, or I'm a terrorist. What kind of information might a company like Google or any other corporation see that they would then want to share with the government?
Well, there are some examples which I think are actually very legitimate. For instance, if there is very kind of concise evidence that, for instance, a set of IP addresses is responsible for trying to intrude into your company's corporate network or something like that, sharing these kind of like very narrow facts about a particular attack mm-hmm. Sometimes can be helpful. And though I don't want to go so far as to say this legislation is necessary, which seems to be a default assumption on Capitol Hill, mm-hmm. I will, you know, certainly admit that there are situations in which sharing information doesn't seem like a bad idea.
So, like a major corporation is under some sort of denial of service attack, and they're able to track where it seems to be coming from. They might want to go to the government and say, "Hey, can you help us out here? It looks like this set of IP addresses is targeting us." They might want to do that. That could be. Am I understanding that? That could be a legitimate thing that a bill might be crafted to help with?
That's right. I would say for denial of service attacks, mm-hmm. it may be less convincing. I would say the more convincing thing are things like malware or mm-hmm. Penetrations, basically.
Okay. So there's somebody spying on my company, has come in, has stolen a bunch of files. Although, wouldn't that already fall under other bills that the FBI could...
Yes. Arguably, the sharing is allowed already. So okay. the reasons for this law are sort of unclear to begin with. There was a FOIA request by the ACLU about this very issue, what was being shared now. And as you might not be surprised to learn that basically no information was given as a result of that FOIA request.
So they won't tell you. Well, yeah.
We don't really know what information is being shared right now already.
Okay.
But if you let me turn to the big problems with the bill.
Yeah.
It basically boils down to the fact that although there are kind of narrow use cases where this might make sense, the definitions of the bill are far too broad and the immunities granted to companies are far too expansive. So I think that's kind of the crux of the problems with the bill. And I can go a bit more into that if you'd like.
Yeah, give me an idea. What sort of worry should I have? What's a not a worst case scenario, but what is a case scenario that could happen that I should be concerned about with this bill?
Sure. Well, for a little background, we have an important privacy law called the Wiretap Act.
Mm-hmm.
The Wiretap Act makes it illegal for anyone to spy on your communications without an appropriate warrant.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if I were to put free Wi-Fi hotspots all around San Francisco, and then I were to kind of secretly record emails sent over those networks and transmit them to the NSA,
mm-hmm.
that would be illegal.
Okay, good.
But unfortunately, under CISPA, it likely would be legal. And the reason is because CISPA allows any self-protected entity to share data, quote, notwithstanding any other provision of law. So this effectively nullifies the Wiretap Act and any other privacy laws and allows the surveillance to take place so long as it relates to a so-called cybersecurity purpose. Now, if cybersecurity purpose were narrow, that would be one thing, but it's so broadly defined that you could say, oh, well, I heard there was a terrorist in San Francisco, and so I had to collect all these emails. I heard that this terrorist might have been using free Wi-Fi hotspots, so I thought that, you know, this related to a cybersecurity purpose.
So at that point, the company, the corporation in this case, goes to the government and says, hey, here's all this information. I think there might be trouble here. There could be a terrorist attack. There could be a cyber attack. Here's all the information. Here's a whole bunch of emails. Here's a whole bunch of places this person has been visiting. Here's all of this personal data that we have tracked on this person. They can go ahead and just give that to the government and say, hey, go find out what's going on here.
That's right. And what's really scary about it is that they can give not just kind of information about isolated incidents,
mm-hmm.
but rather the way the bill's language is set up, they can just as a matter of course just routinely hand over wide swaths of personal information. It wouldn't be surprising under this bill if internet service providers, for instance, handed over the contents of email to government for cybersecurity purposes.
And now, why would they want to do that?
Well, that's a good question. And the bill's backers insist that, oh, it's sharing,
mm-hmm.
it's voluntary. The companies aren't forced to do anything. But we think there's a real concern if the NSA is kind of in the power seat, which they are in this
mm-hmm.
case, that they'll, over time, it will become kind of de facto involuntary.
They'll just start, well, I mean, because a lot of these companies do business with the government, and the government
exactly.
might say, hey, you know what, we'll make things a lot easier for you if you just start shoveling us over all of the data that is stored, all of the phone books that are stored on Google, all of the email. I note that the supporters of this bill, and I should say it's a Republican and a Democratic bill. They have co-sponsored in the House. Most of the supporters that passed the bill yesterday were Republicans, but it was about, I think, 33%, if I have those numbers in my head straight, were actually Democrats who supported this bill. So it seems to be kind of a bipartisan bill, and the proponents of the bill have said in the House they've put up letters of support from groups like the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers. Why would the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers want to support this CISPA cyber spying bill, Dan Auerbach?
Well, I'm not intimately familiar with that organization, so I can't claim to know their exact motivation. But I do think that, it, kind of as a general rule, companies love this because it does give this immunity, notwithstanding any other provision of law. So it doesn't hurt them at all. It just it kind of allows them to, should they choose to share things, they will be able to do so. I do think companies generally cite the part of the bill where the NSA can share information with them. Mm-hmm. That's the part of the bill that, by and large, we think is good. You know, we think if the NSA is privy to some information and wants to share it with companies in order to protect them, that's great. There are some restrictions that are in the bill that make it not perfect, but by and large, that part is good, and that's what companies usually cite. We think that they maybe aren't adequately concerned about, like, the quid pro quo creeping in terms of data sharing. And so that's something where we hope that companies realize, hey, this might not be just a completely voluntary scheme. We might be kind of compelled eventually to disclose data that we don't want to.
AT&T is in support. Boeing is in support. Of course, they sold that software to Egypt. They talked about it at the top of the hour. IBM, Facebook, Oracle. Stick around. Dan Auerbach from EFF. Brad from for the Mike Malloy. Stay with us. To the Mike Malloy Show, Brad Friedman of bradblog.com in for Mike Malloy. And we're talking cyber spying and CISPA, the Cyber Intelligence I can't even remember. We'll get Dan will help me out. Dan, what is it again? Cyber?
I have trouble remembering myself sometimes.
Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. There we go.
There it is.
All right. Speaking with Dan Auerbach of EFF.org, that's the Electronic Frontier Foundation, on what's wrong with CISPA. And frankly, it seems like what isn't wrong with CISPA. A couple of questions for you, Dan. When we see these bills, before this it was the, what was it, SOPA was the previous bill. I mean, they're always trying to do this. Here's my question. You're at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. You're in a coalition with a bunch of other folks who are opposing this CISPA. Did these guys in Congress consult you beforehand? Do they ever come and consult you and say, look, here's the problem we're trying to solve. You guys are civil liberties champions. You're also, you know, a bunch of tech geeks. Can't we work together to make a bill that actually does what is needed to be done but protects people's civil liberties? Do they come to you at all, to the experts on these kinds of bills?
Gee, that would be really nice, wouldn't it?
It would also make sense, wouldn't it?
It would make a lot of sense. Unfortunately, they don't. Very seldom are we consulted. And I think that's just a part of the reality of the power dynamics in Washington, unfortunately being what they are. And while CISPA and SOPA are very different bills, SOPA being about intellectual property enforcement and CISPA mm-hmm. being about surveillance, the one common thread is the fact that we weren't consulted in either case. And Washington just doesn't really listen to the interests of Internet users until we really scream hard at them.
I mean, do you feel, Dan, that the concerns that they at least claim that they're trying to solve by this bill, do you feel that it is something that that you could actually work with them on to craft a bill that could both meet their needs and protect the whatever privacy is left of the citizenry on the Internet?
Absolutely. I think that could definitely happen. And I think the way would be for us to have a more transparent debate about cybersecurity. So as I said, the definitions are so broad. You know, you can give kind of individual examples that make sense, but until we have a better idea of the sort of attacks that they're talking about and what the actual problem is, we can't even start to do that because we don't know how to kind of narrowly tailor the bill to solve those problems.
And they don't tell you what the problems are that they're trying to solve?
Not at all. It's this kind of generic fear-mongering about, oh, we're under attack by China. Isn't China so scary? And there's really no information provided that kind of backs that. In fact, there have been studies that show, so there's a thing called Einstein, which is an intrusion detection, mm-hmm. intrusion prevention system that the government's been using on its own systems for some time. And there's been kind of trials where they've tried to deploy it in the private sector. And there's a peer-reviewed study by Whit Diffie and others that basically say, hey, this doesn't work well. It's not a good idea. This won't make us safer. So if anything, the only publicly available information would suggest that, well, by passing this sort of law, we might be not helping ourselves, but actually making the situation worse.
Oh, well, that would be a shock. I'm looking at the list of people in your coalition opposing this bill, Dan Auerbach, and in the we only got about a minute left here, but, you know, I see American Civil Liberties Union, American Library Association, Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Free Press, Open the Government, Private Rights Clearinghouse, Reporters Without Borders, a bunch of progressive organizations. Are there any of these right-wing anti-big government groups, you know, these folks who claim that the government is taking your rights away? Because I noticed that it's all, not all, but it's the majority is Republicans in support of this. Do you have any Republican groups who are saying, no, this is the very big government intrusion that we have feared? We oppose this bill?
Absolutely, there are. So I don't have the list right in front of me. So I unfortunately don't know if I'll be able to give you an answer.
Well,
I
if we don't know their names, that's fine. I want to know that they're there because these guys pretend they're against Big Brother. They're against big government. You know, but when it comes to these bills, it seems like it's, you know, Republicans who love this. At least there's a few Democrats who are against it. At least Barack Obama is pretending he's going to veto it. Anyway,
no, that's a very good point. And I do think that although there is some support, and the Cato Institute is one organization
good.
I would cite, from kind of the libertarian-leaning community, there really isn't enough. And I agree with you that...
Dan, I got to get out. I appreciate it. I'm coming up on the clock. Dan Auerbach from EFF.org. Thanks, Dan. More straight
ahead.
Thank
you so much.
You bet. Thank you.